Immigration, legal and not, is a hot topic in our time and has been for years and figures to stay that way for a while. As this and any political debate rages, you find reinterpretations and misinterpretations of history. Witness the recent discussions about the reasons for the American Civil War. On the immigration topic, a bit of history from the middle of the 20th century helps to understand, in part, where we are today. So we'll explore the Bracero program now, a program that brought farm workers over the border from Mexico legally for more than two decades. Lena Cordia is a historian, librarian, and teacher. She presents a lecture this week and next from the Southern Oregon Historical Society series Windows in Time called The Fruits of Their Labors, the Bracero Program in Southern Oregon, today at noon at the library in Medford, next Wednesday at noon at the library in Ashland. She's in the studio now. Lena, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thank you.
So Bracero reminds me of the Spanish word for arm, brazo. Is there a connection?
Yes, there is. Bracero basically means arm men, so one who works with their arms or hands.
All right, manual labor. Then,
yep.
So even before there was an official Bracero program, were there previous waves of hiring across the U.S.-Mexican border?
Yes, there were. What we call, I guess historians look at the Bracero program as the largest legal foundation for this type of immigration, or I should say migration. But before that, during the First World War, there was also a huge push to bring Mexican workers north over the border to work in agriculture, and then an attendant program that followed during the Great Depression years that sort of pushed them back. And we see the similar wave going on during the Bracero program as well, with welcoming at first and then a rise in hostility, a large deportation program that actually occurred about in the middle of the program, and then sort of its institutionalization through the end of its final legal expiration.
But if we go even a century further back to when there was first the establishment of a U.S.-Mexican border, I mean, when there began to be American states in the West, I mean, it seems like there were always cross-border movements to work farms, that sort of thing.
That's interesting. If you think about it, if you go back about a century to the mid-1800s, the border crossed them. At the end of the Mexican-American War, Mexico lost about half of its territory, including all of California and the Southwest. And we think of that as the United States, but really, to people at that point in time, that was Mexico.
I've heard of that expression before. We didn't cross the border crossed us. Yes, okay. So by the time we get, you mentioned the First World War program, which it sounds like it was is not a full-blown named official program.
It was very informal.
Uh-huh. All right, so by the time we get to 1942 when the Bracero program starts, what's the set of circumstances here that leads to the discussion of having such a program?
What really happened was the U.S. entry into World War II. What that spurred was not only a bunch of men going and joining up into the armed forces, but also men and women that were not able to be in the military left rural or agricultural areas en masse to go into urban areas to work in war industry because they offered higher pay. So that left the fear among growers that their crops would rot in the fields if nobody came to harvest them.
Interesting. So it wasn't just a matter of people being off the war, but also people who were in the industries that supported war, making a lot more money, making bullets, bombs, whatever, in factories in the cities.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so, was there a mention as the program was set up, what the vision was to length of time, how long it might last, how many people would include, how well detailed, I guess, was the Bracero program when it started in 1942?
That is interesting. It was originally only intended to be during the war. And during the war, it was under a different legal foundation than what followed. It actually went through a few different laws and structures so that we had a binational agreement between Mexico and the United States. So there was sort of a diplomatic agreement. But then there was also a law passed by Congress that sort of stabilized and structured the program. And that started with Public Law 45. So that was in place during the war. But afterward, it went through a few different iterations, different public laws that made their way through Congress. And in 1951, the one that brought us through the end of the program in 64 was Public Law 78. And it was a bit different from what was going on during the war. So originally, it was only intended to be during wartime, but afterward, growers and their lobbies in Congress were so successful at persuading Congress to keep the program going, citing a lack of sufficient laborers for the pay that they were able to give in that industry is what really kept it going.
And what was the pay like in that industry?
Very low.
Mm-hmm. Like below minimum wage at the time? Well, I mean, there was minimum wage established by the time the Bracero program started, right?
There was. And a lot of wage debate occurred in Congress and also at the state level. And grower associations sort of set wages regionally depending on crops that were being grown, which happened here as well. And there was a debate between piecework and an hourly wage. Growers were not in favor of hourly wages because that, in their view, encouraged workers to slow down and not harvest the crops appropriately or at a high speed, which, of course, when we're dealing with perishable items such as produce, if you don't harvest them within a brief amount of time, then you lose money. So growers tended to favor a piece rate, and that can be tricky if you have pickers who aren't able to pick fast enough to hit that minimum wage.
Piecework in the sense of, the, you know, this many pounds gets you this many dollars, that kind of thing?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Lena Cordia is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, historian, librarian, and teacher. She'll be delivering a Windows in Time lecture called The Fruits of Their Labors, the Bracero Program in Southern Oregon, today at noon at the library in Medford, next Wednesday at noon at the library in Ashland. Your comments and questions now are welcome. Maybe you knew somebody who worked on the Bracero Program or did yourself. We'd love to hear from you. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've talked about the demand on the American side. I mean, how acute was it? I mean, were there crops actually rotting in the fields because people weren't there to pick them?
That is the ongoing debate. Scholars tend to fall into the agreement that growers were exaggerating the need for labor, especially because this was also a time in the United States when labor unions were moving out into the agricultural sector. And so for the first time, agricultural laborers were starting to demand fair pay, benefits, unemployment compensation, things of that nature. And that was something that growers just were not set up to provide based on the format of their industry.
So then there were workers on the other side of the border who were willing to work for the wages and conditions that the growers were providing on the American side?
Yes. Looking at about at the mid-40s, the typical hourly wage for an agricultural laborer in Mexico was about 6 to 8 cents an hour. On this side of the border, while low, it was about 30 cents an hour. So that, for somebody coming from something so low, was very appealing. So appealing that men signed up in droves to come across the border and earn some additional money.
If you just go to Wikimedia Commons, where we get a fair amount of our photos for the website, and it's no surprise there. But you enter Bracero program, there's a surprising number of pictures that show large numbers of people. Mm-hmm. Lining up. It sounds like it was a very, very large supply of labor.
It was. It was so many men were volunteering to sign up that there weren't enough contracts to actually allow them all to come.
So were there limits other than the contracts themselves? Were there limits within the law that said, you know, X number of people can come and that's it?
Yes. And that caused a big backup. So there were basically recruitment centers in Mexico. It started with just one, but over time it was expanded into a few. And these centers were places where potential braceros, called aspirantes, so aspirants, they would go and wait, sometimes for months, with very limited funds. So it was hard living. There was not enough shelter for the men, not enough food. They didn't tend to have enough money with them, but it was done by lottery. So each morning, somebody would come out with a loudspeaker, call out the names. The men whose names were called would then go in for processing. Everybody else was stuck waiting.
And how long would some of these aspirantes wait to become braceros?
If they got in, many waited for weeks or as many as a couple of months.
And in some cases, the aspirantes never became braceros? They just had to go back to where they'd come from?
Either they went back to where they had come from, or some chose to cross the border undocumented and seek work that way.
Through the border crossings, or a little less officially?
Less officially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the topic of your discussion, again, is about the Bracero program in Southern Oregon. So, I mean, if people are thinking that folks just stayed along the border, the fact is the Braceros traveled quite a bit from the border.
They did. There was a large infrastructure in place to transport them. So California was the dominant state that was using them, as well as much of the Southwest. But Washington, Idaho, Oregon, so all of the Pacific Northwest utilized braceros for at least part of the program. They even went as far up into the Midwest, up toward Michigan, as well as far into the south as Arkansas.
Wow. And so I mean, what kind of, I have to believe that given the war effort when the Bracero program started in 1942, there weren't a whole lot of spare government workers to do things like track the numbers, check the visas. I mean, do all the things that would keep paperwork and legality in order.
It was mostly done on a state level.
Mm-hmm.
So the binational agreement sort of set standards as well as public law 45. And at the state level, for example, in Oregon, the Extension Service managed, as well as the War Food Administration. So the War Food Administration during the war helped provide housing, making sure that there was adequate housing, primarily in camps set up for the workers as they were coming. And then the Extension Service and the state employment agencies were really what were regulating the numbers of people. They were keeping track of the men by ID numbers that were issued to them and their names. And that's about all the information that was had. The workers themselves had a small ID card that was given to them at their processing centers with one photo, their name, and that ID number, and not much else.
We're talking about the Bracero program, which brought farm workers across the U.S.-Mexican border starting in 1942 and officially until 1964. Lena Cordia, who is a historian, librarian, and teacher, will be delivering a lecture about the program in Southern Oregon today at noon in Medford at the library, next Wednesday at noon at the library in Ashland. You can join the conversation on the exchange now, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Now, I understand Mexico also entered the war in 1942. So it seems like there was still a fair amount of men available for farm worker efforts. And was it just men, or were there women and younger people too?
Only men could be a part of the Bracero program. And this was stemming from growers on the U.S. side of the border that said that men were the... It's a gender bias, but saying that only men were adequate to perform the heavy labor that was needed. But, you know, even though Mexico was an ally during the war and they did send some numbers of troops off to fight, it was very, very few overall. And so for the most part, Mexico had its labor force available. And the other part about sort of the Mexican dynamic is that traditionally they have had an abundance of people ready to work and not necessarily enough jobs to go around. And so that's sort of, even looking into the present, how you see so many people willing and able to cross the border to come either seasonally or permanently up into the United States or into Canada to work.
How long were any of the braceros supposed to stay individually? I mean, were there limits upon how long any one of them could be in the United States before they had to go back to Mexico? I mean, would the braceros of this year become back in the aspirantes of next year, that sort of thing?
Yes. So it was very cyclical, as with harvest cycles. So braceros were brought over on contracts that were typically about 90 days, although they could be extended to as many as 180 days, depending on the worker, the reviews they were getting from growers, and the need. And so what that meant is that a bracero who was particularly well-liked by a grower could have his contract renewed and so stay for a longer period of time from the original 90 days if there was labor available. And then for people that were not necessarily in that situation, they could be sent back early. There was a lot of movement. And then people who had previously been braceros would have sort of preferential treatment the next time around once they were back in Mexico if they decided to come and do that again the next time.
So given the regulation on the fields themselves from the people who held the contracts, and you mentioned a lot of state-level interest in making sure that things stayed legal, were there sort of shadowy places where things weren't entirely legal, where braceros would come back but not officially as braceros in subsequent years?
Yes. And I don't know if I can actually say this on air, but there was a term for this process, and it was called drying out the wetbacks, as horrible as that sounds. Mm-hmm. And what that was is growers taking advantage of the fact that undocumented workers can be paid less than those under contract in an official government-sanctioned program. And not only that, but the standards of housing or food production, anything that growers are providing to them can be done at a lower standard when it's an undocumented laborer, because they have no recourse, no legal recourse to tell on the grower to be that person saying, hey, you know, this is wrong what you're doing here.
Yeah, if you're not in the country legally, you have no basis to say, hey, look, you know, they're breaking the law. Oops. Yeah, I see the point.
Exactly. And so some growers, particularly in Texas and in the Southwest and California, really started to take advantage of their proximity to the border and their ability to obtain undocumented workers to supplement any labor force.
I keep coming back to the Bracero program generally and wandering away from the Northwest specifically. But this, so what were some of the industry? I mean, all the pear orchards were pretty well roaring in the Rogue Valley by that time. Were they using Bracero workers?
Yes. And so around here in Jackson County, the pear harvests were the only things that Braceros worked in. Throughout the rest of the Northwest, it was a lot of orchard crops. So we had a lot of pears, apples. In some parts of the state, like Athena, there were peas. Cherry trees around the Willamette Valley. So different crops from California, which is well known for row crops, where everybody's, you know, bending low to the ground and harvesting things like lettuce or strawberries.
As opposed to the orchard crops, which are at least get to reach up as opposed to down into the trees. Any idea what the total numbers were? I mean, just to give an idea of what the numbers were like, it looks like they were about 4,000 braceros in the year 1942. 5 years later, it was up to nearly 20,000. Hit its peak in the mid-50s, 1956, at 445,000, almost half a million braceros in the program. And this is now 11 years after World War II ended, which was listed as the original reason for having a Bracero program. Any idea what the numbers were in the Northwest and in the Rogue Valley in particular?
Yeah, in the Northwest after the war, we see a major reduction in the total numbers. So during the war, it was a few thousand per state, so Washington, Oregon, Idaho, for pretty much each year, just generally. And after the war, it dropped substantially from going to kind of a region or a statewide usage to very local countywide usage. So in Oregon specifically, after the war, only Hood River, Athena, and Medford were using braceros. And that actually stopped over time as well, with Jackson County being the only county in Oregon that used them through 64.
So are there descendants of braceros still living in Jackson County, people who stayed after the Bracero program ended?
The ability to stay was a bit tricky because each bracero did have to go back home, and they also weren't allowed to bring their wives and children with them. So most went home, although some did come back later and settle. I've talked to a few different people who talk about their parents being either migrant laborers or braceros themselves, and there was one person in particular that I haven't been able to track any more recent information on, but his name was Alfonso Gonzalez, and the records that I've looked at historically note that he came as a bracero and then later came back and worked for the Fruit Growers League here in Jackson County, first as a camp cook, then as a camp manager, and sort of in various capacities for throughout the program.
I'm struck by the waves of sort of replacements here, where this group of people picks up and moves on, as happened with people who left the fields to go work in the factories during the war, and then the braceros were brought in to replace them. Did those people ever come back from the factories? I mean, did farm workers come back from American cities or from jobs elsewhere to work the fields that the braceros had been working?
Some did, although the difference, I think, when those that did come home arrived back is that they were used to a higher standard of living with the higher wages they'd been paid in war industries. And so many people didn't want to go back to picking crops in the fields. It is hard work. It's hard physically. The hours are difficult, and it's very seasonal, highly seasonal, especially with pears, where the peak time to pick them is from about late August until October. And that's it. And so growers faced that difficulty as well, where there were people available, there were unemployed people, but they weren't willing to do the work. And so there was a lot of discussion in the Mail Tribune throughout these decades about how there were this many unemployed people, yet the growers weren't able to find a sufficient workforce.
Which has been one of the dynamics in immigration for a very long time, it seems like.
Yes, it has.
So why did the Bracero program finally end when it did? I mean, if I look at the fact that in 1956 it hit its peak with 445,000 plus people coming over the border, and still in 1961, we're talking now 15 years plus after World War II ended, more than 250,000 braceros in the country. What finally led to the program being dismantled?
There were a few different factors that led to its end, and these were sort of nationwide factors. One of them was the opposition from labor unions. Another was from church groups, advocacy groups, talking about the quality of life that braceros were living in the United States. And this has a lot to do with exploitation. As the program matured, growers increasingly were able to exploit braceros, undocumented laborers, really manipulate their labor force, as well as domestic migrant laborers, because that's another huge labor force that nobody seems to consider in a lot of our talk about agriculture. And
that there are people within the United States who travel from place to place working
exactly.
crops.
Mm-hmm. And so in 1960, Edward R. Murrow premiered his damning expose, Harvest of Shame.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on Thanksgiving Day, of course, because he wanted to put that counterpoint as all these American families enjoyed a feast in their homes. All of these people that actually pick the crops are living in abject poverty and they're U.S. citizens. So that it sparked a lot of debate about who is picking our crops? Where are they coming from? What is their quality of life like? And then unions really latched onto this, church groups as far as talking about human decency and how we treat people, citizens or not, really came to Congress and started lobbying to end the program. And sort of what punctuated this is something that occurred in California, and you can call it the Chualar Massacre almost. It was the deadliest bus train accident in U.S. history. And what happened was a truck or a bus carrying a large number of braceros with their tools, sharp tools for cutting lettuce and the crops they had picked for the day, collided with a train down in the Salinas Valley in California. And most of the men on board died, and it was completely avoidable. They were not buckled in.
Oh.
There were no seats available for them, and they were riding with sharp tools and instruments. It was something that looked like a bomb exploded.
Right, so that was one of the things that hastened the end of the program, plus the fact that they had war on poverty and other programs going on in the American states. Lena Cordia, historian, librarian, teacher. Her lecture is called The Fruits of Their Labors, the Bracero Program in Southern Oregon, today at noon at the library in Medford, next Wednesday at noon at the library in Ashland. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.